This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everyone. This is Tracy Schoester, and today I'll be reading from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for Sunday, April 28th, 2024. First up, Cher, Dave Matthews Band, and A Tribe Called Quest joined Rock Hall of Fame. Mary J. Blige and Ozzy Osbourne were also voted in, but Sinead O'Connor, who died last year at 56, did not make the cut. Cher, Ozzy Osbourne, Peter Frampton, and Mary J. Blige are part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's Class of 2024, along with Dave Matthews Band, Kool & the Gang, Foreigner, and A Tribe Called Quest, the Hall announced on Sunday. The latest crop of stars will officially join the Pantheon in a ceremony on October 19th at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse in Cleveland, where the Hall's affiliated museum is also located. The 39th annual group of inductees matches the Hall's genre and demographic spread of recent years, with a pop diva, Cher, a metal idol, Osbourne, a top funk band of 1970s and 80s vintage, Kool & the Gang, a couple of 90s hip-hop and R&B heroes, Blige and Tribe, and rock mainstays from the Boomer, Frampton Foreigner, and Gen X, Matthews, eras. Of those artists, four were elevated to the Hall on their first nomination: Cher, Foreigner, Frampton, and Kool & the Gang. Osbourne was nominated for the first time as a solo act, though he had joined the Hall as part of Black Sabbath in 2006. The Rock Hall has come under increasing pressure in recent years to diversify its ranks, with more women and artists of color, and has made progress in that regard, though some critics say it is not enough. Rock and roll is an ever-evolving amalgam of sounds that impacts culture and moves generations, John Sykes, chairman of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation, said in a statement. This diverse group of inductees each broke down musical barriers and influenced countless artists that followed in their footsteps. Seven acts that were nominated in February did not make the cut: Mariah Carey, Jane's Addiction, Oasis, Sade, Eric B. and Rakim, Lenny Kravitz, and perhaps most surprisingly, Sinead O'Connor, whose death last year at age 56 elicited a global outpouring of grief and a reconsideration of her place in rock history. The Hall will also honor the blues musicians Alex Korner, John Mayall, and Big Mama Thornton with the Musical Influence Award, while Jimmy Buffett, Dionne Warwick, the MC5, and the Motown producer and songwriter Norman Whitfield will receive an honor for musical excellence. Suzanne DePass, a film and television producer who was a longtime executive at Motown, will receive the Ahmet Erdogan Award for Non-Performers. Artists become eligible for nomination 25 years after the release of their first recording. The nominations are voted on by more than 1,000 music historians, industry professionals, and inducted artists. This year, close watchers of the Rock Hall's opaque voting process had anticipated the arrival of at least a couple of this year's inductees. One is Frampton, the English-born guitarist and singer-songwriter who played in the band Humble Pie in the late 1960s and early 70s, and then had a successful solo career, most notably with his monster hit double LP, Frampton Comes Alive, from 1976. At last year's ceremony, Sheryl Crow had Frampton join her on stage, a seeming endorsement. And Cher essentially made her own case when she noted on an episode of The Kelly Clarkson Show in December that she has had number one songs as part of Sonny and Cher, or on her own, in each of the last 7 decades, but was not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. "Wait, are you serious?" Clarkson said. "I wouldn't be in it now if they gave me $1 million," Cher answered. "I'm never going to change my mind. They can just go you-know-what themselves." Next up, climate doom is out. Apocalyptic optimism is in. Focusing on disaster hasn't changed the planet's trajectory. Will a more upbeat approach show a way forward? The philanthropist, Catherine Murdoch, has prioritized donations to environmental causes for more than a decade. She has, she said, a deep understanding of how inhospitable the planet will become if climate change is not addressed. And she and her colleagues have spent years trying to communicate that. We have been screaming, she said, but screaming only gets you so far. This was on a morning in early spring. Murdoch and Ari Wallach, an author, producer, and futurist, had just released their new PBS docuseries, A Brief History of the Future, and had hopped onto a video call to promote it. Politely, no screaming required. Shot cinematically in some never-ending golden hour, the 6-episode show follows Wallach around the world as she meets with scientists, activists, and the occasional artist and athlete, all of whom are optimistic about the future. An episode might include a visit to a floating village or a conversation about artificial intelligence with the musician Grimes. In one sequence, marine biologists lovingly restore a rehabbed coral polyp to a reef. The mood throughout is mellow, hopeful, even dreamy, which is deliberate. There's room for screaming, Wallach said, and there's room for dreaming. A Brief History of the Future joins some recent books and shows that offer a rosier vision of what a world in the throes, or just past the throes, of global catastrophe might look like. Climate optimism as opposed to climate fatalism. Hannah Ritchie's Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet, argues that many markers of disaster are less bad than the public imagines. Deforestation, overfishing, or easily solvable plastics in the oceans. In Fallout, the television adaptation of the popular video game that recently debuted on Amazon Prime Video, the apocalypse, nuclear, not climate-related, makes for a devastated Earth, sundry mutants, and plenty of goofy, kitschy fun. Apocalypse light. Life as We Know It Can Be, a book by Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent, that is structured as a series of letters to his son, centers on human potential and resilience. And Dana R. Fisher's Saving Ourselves, From Climate Shocks to Climate Action, contends that the disruptions of climate change may finally create a mass movement that will lead to better global outcomes. Fisher, a sociologist, coined the term apocalyptic optimism to describe a belief that humans can still avoid the worst ravages of climate change. In confronting the apocalypse, these works all insist that hope matters. They believe that optimism, however qualified or hard won, may be what finally moves us to action. While Americans are less likely than their counterparts in the developed world to appreciate the threats that climate change poses, recent polls show that a significant majority of Americans now agree that climate change is real, and a smaller majority agree that it is human-caused and harmful. And yet, almost no expert believes that we are doing enough in terms of technology, legislation, or political pressure to alleviate these harms. Intimations of doom have failed to motivate us. Perhaps we will work toward a better future if we trust that one, with or without mutants, is possible. When it comes to climate catastrophe, is our best hope, hope itself? For the past 50 years, and perhaps even before, most imaginative projections of the future have seen it through dark glasses, as World's Fair-style visions of jetpacks and gleaming cities gave way to arid landscapes populated by zombie hordes and rogue AI. The appeal of a dystopia in terms of entertainment is obvious. The stakes, the survival of humanity, are enormous and the potential for action vast. There have been occasional utopian inventions, such as Kim Stanley Robinson's extraordinary 2020 climate change novel, The Ministry for the Future. But in most cases, a future of environmental responsibility and cooperation with or without jetpacks rarely makes for a bestseller or a blockbuster. Paradoxically, it was the likes of The Hunger Games and the Mad Max franchise that inspired Murdoch, the wife of James Murdoch, the former chief executive of 21st Century Fox, to create a brief history of the future. One day, her daughter, then 16, surprised Murdoch by telling her that she didn't feel there was a future to look forward to. The books, films, television shows, and graphic novels the girl consumed all took a dim view of humanity's chances. None imagined a future more hopeful than the present. So Murdoch and Wallach, partners in Futurific Studios, set out to sketch one, which they hope to follow with video games and fiction films. Two graphic novels are already in the works. The goal for A Brief History of the Future wasn't to ignore climate change or other seam rippers of the social fabric, but in classic Mr. Rogers style, to look to the helpers. There's a huge amount of focus in the news and storytelling in general on what could go horribly wrong, Murdoch said. What I really wanted to highlight was all the work that's happening right now to make things go right. This was also Richie's project. A data scientist by training, she began her career overwhelmed by climate pessimism. That feeling of hopelessness took a personal toll and a professional one, she believes, interfering with her ability to turn her mind toward solutions. Scientist colleagues who had once needed to push back against the public's climate skepticism were now facing people who believed in a coming global catastrophe, perhaps too much. There's been a really rapid shift in the narrative, from almost complete denial to, oh, it's too late now, there's nothing we can do, we should stop trying, Richie said. Anger, fear, and sorrow might motivate some people, Richie said, but they hadn't motivated her. Her book, which emphasizes the progress that has already been made, clean energy, and the progress that might still be made, increased crop yields, is a deliberate alternative, participating in what she calls impatient optimism. Doomerism is not only a bummer, she argues, it's also a cliché. The more negative slant, it's already been done a million times, she said. But a bummer may be what we deserve. Climate activism has scored the occasional win, a reduced hole in the ozone layer, the comeback of the California condor. Still, any sustained inquiry into the challenges we face in the future, and even right now, as the world warms faster than predicted, offers a gloomier prospect. To emphasize a cheerier one, examples tend to be cherry-picked or gently massaged. A section in Richie's book argues, correctly, that deaths from extreme weather events are fewer than they were in the past. But this section all but ignores the fact that extreme weather events are becoming more severe and more frequent, a trend that will continue even if harmful emissions are slowed. And it ignores any deaths from extreme heat, which Richie attributed in conversation to the insufficiency of the data. The journalist Jeff Goodell has studied that data. The title of his recent book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet, suggests a more sober perspective. In conversation, he described himself as broadly bullish about the climate crisis, which came as a surprise. He wanted to use his storytelling, he said, not necessarily to inspire hope or even anger, but to communicate what the planet faces. Because you can't talk about solutions until you understand the scope and scale, he said. He is also skeptical, he said, of much of the sunny, solutions-minded messaging. It makes it feel like climate change is like a broken leg, he said. With a broken leg, you're in a cast for 6 or 8 weeks. You suffer some pain, then you go back into your old life. He doesn't believe that's the case here. We're not going to fix this, he said. It's going to be, how do we manage to live in this new world? The fixes on offer in these recent works tend to be of the techno-futuristic variety, trusting in human ingenuity. A Brief History of the Future also offers squishier solutions, empathy, community, trust. Sacrifice, unhopeful, unsexy, is rarely mentioned, or it's the kind that a person in relative economic comfort can feel good about, eating less red meat, driving an electric car. Not the End of the World is almost determinedly apolitical, though there is one mention of a populist campaign to ease air pollution and a polite reminder to vote for leaders who support sustainability. I deliberately wanted to make this a very nonpartisan book, Ritchie said. Introducing specific policies might have alienated some readers. I feel like that would split my audience when I want to try to bring them together, she said. The desire to engage audiences across the political spectrum also motivated Murdoch. While there is one brief interview with President Emmanuel Macron of France and another with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, the series is far more comfortable when discussing rewilding or kelp farming. If we're going to get there, we need everybody, Murdoch said. So part of this is to try to not have it be about politics, but really to be about the future. Can a better future arrive without political intervention? Fisher doesn't think so. Her book, Saving Ourselves, From Climate Shocks to Climate Action, which she describes as a data-driven manifesto, posits a world in which climate shocks become so great that they spur mass protest and force government and industry to transition to clean energy. It's the most realistically hopeful way to think about where we get to the other side of the climate crisis, she said. That realism imagines a future of food scarcity, water scarcity, climate-spurred migration, and increasing incidences of extreme weather. Fisher also predicts some level of mass death. There's no question that there are going to be lives lost, she said. Already lives are being lost, which may not sound especially optimistic. But Fisher's research has taught her to believe in, as she terms it, people power. She has found that people who have had a visceral experience of climate change are more likely to be angry and active rather than doomy and depressed. The whole point of apocalyptic optimism is being optimistic in a way that actually helps us get somewhere, she said. It's not shiny and rosy and like cotton candy. It's a bitter pill, but here we are and we can still do something. In this sense, hope is a spur, a prod, an uncomfortable goad, and imagining a better future is a brave and even necessary act. Storytelling, whether through fiction, documentary, data science, or sociology, and however optimistic, might seem a limp response to the climate crisis. Narrative won't stop coral bleaching or the leaking of methane from Arctic soil into the atmosphere, but it's a tool that's available, cheap, and endlessly renewable. And as a society, we will not act on climate change until we're convinced that our action is useful and urgent. In order to build a better world, Ritchie said, you need to be able to envision that one is possible. Next up, nonfiction. Barbara Walters did the work. In The Rule Breaker, Susan Page pays tribute to a pioneering journalist who survived being both a punchline and an icon. The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters by Susan Page. Much of the material in The Rule Breaker, The Life and Times of Barbara Walters has been told before, with persuasive narrative control by the late television journalist herself in her dishy 2008 memoir, Audition. Don't let that stop the reader of this thorough, compassionate biography by Susan Page. It's a valuable document, sobering, where Audition aimed for sassy. If anything, the 16 long years between autobiography and biography endow the two books, taken together, with a memento mori gravitas for any student of Walters or of television journalism or of the past, present, and future of women in the TV workplace, or, for that matter, of Monica Lewinsky. More on her in a moment. Walters called her autobiography Audition to emphasize the need she always felt to prove herself, pushing her way to professional success in a world that never made it easy for her. Nearly 80 then, and still in the game, she acknowledged that personal contentment, love, marriage, meaningful family connections lagged far behind. She wrote of being the daughter of an erratic father who bounced, sometimes suicidally, between flush times and financial failure as a nightclub owner and empresario. She told of her fearful mother and of the mentally disabled older sister to whose welfare she felt yoked. She wrote of the three unsatisfying marriages and of her strained relationship with the daughter she adopted as an infant. She breezily acknowledged the ease she felt throughout her life with complicated men of elastic ethics like Roy Cohn and Donald Trump. She leaned into her reputation as a pushy cookie. Page, the Washington bureau chief of USA Today, who has also written books about Barbara Bush and Nancy Pelosi, tells many of the same stories. Audition is an outsized presence in the endnotes. But in placing the emphasis on all the rule-breaking Barbara Jill Walters had to do over her long life, she died in 2022 at the age of 93, the biographer pays respect to a toughness easy to undervalue today, when the collective memory may see only the well-connected woman with the instantly recognizable, thanks to Gilda Radner's SNL impression, speech impediment. There was no one like her. Not Diane, not Katie, not Judy, not Connie, not Gwen, not Christiane, not Ellen, not Oprah. Having created her niche, Walters fought all her life to protect it, because no one else would. Would that be the case today? Discuss. At age 35, Page writes, she had finally found her place, a space that bridged journalism and entertainment and promotion. Traditionalists viewed the combination with consternation. She ignored their doubts as she redefined their industry. She saw herself as a journalist, albeit of a new and evolving sort. In some ways, she could make herself a leader in the news business by changing what, exactly, that could include. Walters broke rules to save her father from debt and jail. She broke rules to secure on-air status and salary equal to that of the often hostile men around her. Walters broke rules to land scoops, gain access, and bag interviews. The account of the driven competition she felt with her fellow TV journalist Diane Sawyer is both fun and silly sad in its evocation of a catty rumble. Isn't such competition the everyday reality of the bookers working for the famous men who currently host late-night talk shows? Aren't those late-night hybrids now the closest thing we have to influential news interviews, except perhaps on the woman-talking daytime show The View, invented in large part by Barbara Walters? Walters didn't break rules to get the first on-air interview with Monica Lewinsky. She just worked her tuchus off from the day the news of an affair broke to the night of March 3rd, 1999, watched by 74 million Americans. Walters was nearly 70 and famous. Lewinsky was a private 25-year-old woman whose affair with her married boss had thrown a country into hypocritical hysterics. The process of establishing trust could not be rushed. The older woman asked the younger woman a chain of tough questions about sex and intimacy and character and judgment that no human should have to endure on national television. The younger woman answered with a dignity currently out of fashion, both in celebrity self-presentation and on the floor of the U.S. Congress. In the quarter century since that extraordinary event, the essence of a Barbara Walters interview, Lewinsky has demonstrated an inspiring power to live on her own terms and not on the assumptions of others. The achievement required rules to be broken and has come with a price. Barbara Walters knew what that was like. And our next article. Prince Harry hits the polo field in front of Netflix cameras. The Duke of Sussex competed in a match in South Florida the day after the announcement that he will be working on a new polo-related Netflix project. In front of rolling cameras and a crowd of nearly 300 guests, Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex, barreled toward one end of a polo field in South Florida on Friday. "The Duke of Sussex may score a goal," an announcer cried through a loudspeaker at the Royal Salute Polo Challenge to benefit Centebale, which was attended by spectators including Serena Williams and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, and by film crews with Netflix. The streamer is producing a polo-related project with Harry and Meghan that was announced on Thursday and that will be filmed in Wellington, an affluent area near Palm Beach known for its equestrian scene. The announcer and many in the crowd groaned audibly when Harry missed the shot. He was wearing a blue and white jersey with the number 2 on it, along with a logo for Centibale, a charitable organization he founded to support children in the African countries Lesotho and Botswana, and a logo for Royal Salute, a whiskey brand and a sponsor of the invitation-only charity match involving 3 teams. The event took place at the Grand Champions Polo Club, and its organizers included Melissa and Mark Ganzi, members of Wellington's polo community, as well as the founders of the World Polo League and the owners of the Grand Champions Club. The Ganzis also own the Santa Rita Polo Farm in Wellington and the Aspen Valley Polo Club in Colorado. Mr. Ganzi is the chief executive of Digital Bridge, an investment firm formerly known as Colony Capital, where he succeeded Thomas J. Barrick Jr., the chairman of former President Donald J. Trump's inaugural committee. Harry, 39, one of the highest-profile polo players in the world, competed in the match with other stars of the sport, like the renowned Argentine player Adolfo Cambiaso, the English player Malcolm Borwick, an ambassador for Royal Salute, and Nacho Figueras, the Argentine athlete who has regularly faced off against Harry on polo fields and whose career has made him a face not only of the sport, but also of Ralph Lauren, a brand that has intertwined its identity with polo. Harry's team ultimately won the match and was presented with a trophy by Meghan, who received cheers from the crowd as she approached a podium on stage to deliver the award in a cream-colored Heidi Merrick halter dress and towering nude Aquazura pumps. Meghan, after being assisted up a staircase to the stage, walked past the other players on the winning team and straight toward her husband. "Me?" Harry said jokingly to his wife, pointing toward his chest and feigning surprise, before the couple leaned in for a rather cinematic kiss. The Netflix cameras were there, after all. Their polo project is one of 2 newly announced initiatives involving their multi-layered deal with the streamer. The other project, according to Deadline, will focus on Meghan and activities like cooking, gardening, and entertaining. Last month, Meghan, 42, announced on social media the start of another new venture, a lifestyle brand called American Riviera Orchard, about a week before Catherine, Princess of Wales, revealed she had been diagnosed with cancer. The Royal Salute Polo Challenge came at the end of the professional polo season in the United States, which takes place largely in Wellington from January through April. The U.S. Open Polo Championship finals are scheduled to take place next weekend at the National Polo Center in Wellington. The professional tour then moves to Europe for the summer and to South America in the fall. As Mr. Borwick, the English player, put it, polo season follows the sun. In an interview before the match on Friday, he said that the sport has changed so much as investments in polo have transformed it into a fully professional sport. It used to be perfectly acceptable to leave the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning and go play professional polo the next day, Mr. Borwick said, describing the sport's evolution as an incredible journey. For us as professionals going on that journey, it has been a challenge to continually adapt and change, Mr. Borwick said. Well, that's all the time that we have for our show today. Thanks for joining me as I read from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for Sunday, April 28th, 2024. Until next time, this is Tracy Shoster. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day today.